We have several bills on the agenda, members. First, we're going to hear House File 196, Representative Greiling. Representative Greiling, welcome to the committee. I will move your bill when we have a quorum. You can introduce your amendments, but we can't act on them until we have a quorum. So maybe you'd just like to present your bill and your testifiers.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate that. I understand not having a quorum. That happens in K-12 education finance, too. The First Amendment, A-23, is an amendment that deletes page 18, Section 6, and somehow, I don't know why, I don't seem to have my bill to somebody, I guess. I came with it today and don't have it. Here we go. Okay, thank you. This is deleting the Crisis Intervention Team State Council. That has not been acceptable. We decided just to have regular grants that are administered by the Commissioner of Public Safety. So that's what this amendment does. And then, Mr. Chair and members, A-27 is on page 20, section 8, deleting the Mental Health Fatality Review Team. That is, while a good idea, it turned out to not have been worked out carefully, and the players have not agreed on how that will work. And so for now, for this year, we are needing to delete it. And then I have, Mr. Chair, an oral amendment to add on to that amendment on page 5, deleting section 2, and page 6, deleting section 3. And actually, those two sections were deleted with agreement in the mental health division, but due to a clerical error in the engrossment, they did not end up being deleted. So we would like to get the bill cleaned up so we don't have that confusion as we go forward, because those sections are opposed by the sheriffs, etc.
Representative Greiling, so the amount for the public safety grants, do we have an appropriation amount, or in this new language in Section 6, or does this come under a current funding stream under the Office of Justice Program? Or?
Mr. Chair and members, you know, I have not yet seen the fiscal notes. I'm going to defer any fiscal questions to Mr. Carter. Last I knew, I had checked with him. He asked for the fiscal note right away, but we hadn't been able to get one yet. And I have just heard through the grapevine that there is one, but I haven't seen it yet.
we'll get back to the Representative Greiling. We have a preliminary fiscal note that is not totally completed. Let's give Mr. Carter a few moments here. Maybe you can have your testifiers present, or unless you want to walk through the components that are germane to this committee.
Mr. Chair, I could do that, or I could have the testifiers and wait for more members, whichever you would prefer.
Doesn't matter.
Okay, I'll go through it first then, Mr. Chair and members. On the first section that pertains to this committee is Article 3, Section 6, and that is on page 18. That's the amendment we just talked about, and instead of creating the Crisis Intervention Council, it now is the grants administered by the Department of Public Safety. The second part that refers to this committee is on page, and I'm actually going not in order of the bill, but in order of my notes here. On page 6, Article 1, Section 4, this requires a mental health screening tool to be part of the intake procedure for inmates at jails. And then Article 1, page 5.
Representative Greiling, can I just ask you on, did you just say Section 3 or Section 4?
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry to be confusing. I have some notes here, and based on the flow of the topics, not the flow of the bill. So the first one was Article 3.
Okay.
That was the one, the same as the amendment that we have.
Right.
But this next one is Article 1, page 6, Section 4.
Oh, Section 4, okay.
And it's line 614, talking about the mental health screening. And this is part of the intake procedure for new prisoners.
And Representative Dreiling, does this particular screening tool exist, or is this something that will be developed?
Mr. Chair, it exists, and it's free, and it's short.
Very good. And Section 5 also is germane to this bill, I assume, on Article 1?
Mr. Chair, yes. That is the County Jail Reentry Project, and that does have an appropriation. This would provide grants to applicants who voluntarily apply to receive the grant. The target population would be persons having a mental illness identified, traumatic injury, chemical dependency, history of homelessness, and then the county jail would collaborate with the county social services.
Representative Dreiling, at least on this, on the first engrossment, these are all blank appropriations, unless Mr. Carter has something different.
Mr. Chair, I just printed out the preliminary fiscal note for this bill, and I haven't had a chance to review it. The only thing I quickly glanced, public safety has an appropriation for $144,000, and I think that's what's in the bill. But this fiscal note is 36 pages long, so, and I don't think Corrections has completed their part on it yet, nor has the courts.
Well, Representative Dreiling, do you have a sense of how much these reentry projects would cost?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to ask Sue Abderholden, who's the executive director, she's going to tell the witness here. Mr. Chair, I do not. I, like I said, haven't seen this fiscal note. This bill was introduced early in the session, but the advocates, this was worked on, this bill, by the Mental Health Legislative Network, about 20 organizations, and they themselves did not fill in the blank until well after the bill was introduced.
Okay. Representative Dreiling, we now have a quorum, so the chair will move House File 196, and we will, with a recommendation that it will be referred to finance, with a recommendation that it be re-referred to the Committee on Health Care and Human Services Finance Division. Representative Dreiling, let's do your amendments now.
Okay, Mr. Chair, that'll be fine.
So should we take the A23 first? On page 18, deleting section 6 and inserting the new language regarding crisis intervention team grants. And this is the DPS money that for these grants. Is there discussion on the A23 amendment? The chair will move this amendment. Anything you want to say, Representative Dreiling, anymore?
Mr. Chair, no, unless people have questions that didn't hear my earlier statements.
Okay. All those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That amendment prevails. Then the A27 amendment on page 20. Deleting section, it's not right. Deleting section 8. This is the Mental Health Fatality Review Team, and then an oral amendment to delete in Article 1, delete section 2 and 3. Any further comments on that, Representative Dreiling?
No, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Any discussion? Representative Murphy.
Are those two together then, rather than separate?
She made the oral amendment to the amendment, as I understand. Any further discussion? All those in favor of that amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That amendment prevails. Okay, Representative Dreiling, now I think we're set.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. It's nice to have such a very organized chair, keeping track of all these things. So we went over the crisis grants. I don't know if you had any more questions, Mr. Chair, or anyone on the intake procedure and the screening tool, but that will be covered in the testimony, and the actual screening tool will be a handout. so that might make sense when we take the testifiers. There is a small portion of this bill that applies on page 5, Article 1, down there with 515 to 518, and this is the section that makes the inmates eligible for GAMC for 3 months after their release.
Which, I'm sorry, Representative Gravin, which page are you on?
Page 5, lines 515 to 518.
Okay, I see.
And, Mr. Chair, this would be helpful to reduce recidivism if they're being treated in jail and then they have this gap while they get organized. They could be back before they get their first appointment. And then on page 6, I guess I already went through that, the jail reentry project. And then page 8.
Representative Gravin, on the county jail reentry projects, are these modeled after any other county reentry projects or any other communities that are dealing with inmates who have mental health problems, or are you asking the department to create something?
Mr. Chair, I think that would be a good question for the testifiers, but this is not uncommon around the country, but specifically where it's being done and et cetera, I could not answer that question. But I do serve on the National Alliance on Mental Illness National Board, and we've certainly discussed these sorts of initiatives in other states.
Do you want to have your testifiers present now, or you have anything else you want to...
Mr. Chair, I have... two more sections to highlight,
okay.
If you want me to finish that, or
yes, please,
your
do.
Pleasure. Okay. Well, then, excuse me. Frog in my throat. Page 8, Article 1, Section 6. This one is protocol for disciplinary confinement. This is a section that we did deal with in the mental health division that Mr. Chair will be familiar with the discussion, and this is what we ended up with. There's concern that people with mental illness are disproportionately placed in segregation, and then a further concern is sometimes they're released from segregation to the outside world, and that is really not a good thing for them and certainly not for the safety of the public. So, this is to develop that protocol because the protocol that was developed by the advocates was not, not workable according to the implementers that were going to have to implement that. Department of Corrections had concerns about that. So it needs some further study. And then page 8, this is on line 8.32, discharge planning. This would require mental health release planning for all inmates in prisons with serious and persistent mental illness. And the testifiers will bring forward information, but the Minnesota Department of Corrections has reported that 63% of inmates who have a plan, because some of them have plans right now, did not return to prison compared to 51% who did not have a plan. But there is funding needed to adequately reach the offenders that would qualify. And the overall rate of completion currently is only 13%. And then finally, on page 9.4, this is funding for the mental health courts that would go to the Supreme Court to develop and implement standards for mental health courts. Right now, Mr. Chair, this committee probably knows there are two mental health courts, one in Ramsey County and one in Hennepin County. And Mr. Chair, those are the parts of this bill that pertain to this committee, and I believe there are three testifiers. The first already sitting here to my left.
So just a minute, Representative Gravin. Commissioner Benson, I don't know if you're prepared to respond to any of this, but the fiscal note is somewhat preliminary, and I think this committee would want to know what the costs. We don't have a cost yet to the courts, but do we have a cost yet to corrections, or are you not prepared at this point? Sir, if you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
I'm Steve Allen, Director of Behavioral Health with the Minnesota Department of Corrections.
We were just trying to get a sense, since we don't have a completed fiscal note here, what the fiscal impact to the Department of Corrections might be.
Mr. Chair and members, we have provided this information to the Department of Human Services because it's our understanding that the funding would go through the Department of Human Services for release planning as it's done in the past. I do have a note here that I can provide to the committee. The primary cost of the Department of Corrections that would be related to this bill would be the increase in the number of release planners designated, and the total annual cost for what we estimate to be four additional release planners would be $329,500.
And John, the grant program to the Commissioner of Corrections for fiscal year 08 and 09, that, do you have anything to say
about that? Mr. Chair and members, we have on a separate a document that I can provide you, we're estimating it would be a one full-time position in years beginning 2008 through 2011, grants specialist intermediate, and I'm not seeing a cost set aside for that, but we can get that for you.
And the author, it's not apparently decided how much the grant program appropriation is. Is that why you're not? There's a blank appropriation on the bill, and I didn't know if that has changed at all.
Let me take a quick look at this note. In terms of the grant specialist, the cost we've estimated to that for one full-time position would be $65,000 annually. I'll take a quick look to see if we have additional information on the grant itself.
Mr. Chairman? Mr. Chairman?
Please introduce.
Sue Abdeholden from NAMI, Minnesota. When we worked with the counties, we assumed that it would take perhaps two people to really help fully carry out a discharge planning on the local level, maybe one in a smaller county. So just averaging it out, we figured it would be about $126,000 per year per project. So if you decided to fund, you know, one project, it would be $126,000 per year. If you decided to do two projects, obviously it would be double that.
But what is the grant? What is the grant amount that you're asking for?
That would be for the grant amount. So depending on how many grants you decided to cover, we think three would be a wonderful number to try it in a.
I didn't hear the first one you said that.
$126,000 per year.
$126,000 per year. Very good. Thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Allen.
You're welcome.
Anything else, Mr. Carter?
Just the mental health folks.
We'll have to get the number on the impact of the courts for the mental health choice. President Greiling, can your testifiers make some brief comments?
Yep.
We're running a little out of time here.
I think they all heard to be very brief.
Okay. Please introduce yourself.
Hi, my name is Tara Long from NAMI, Minnesota. As part of my position at NAMI Minnesota, I travel to county jails and provide information and awareness about mental illness to correctional staff. Last spring, NAMI came up with a survey that we conducted of all the Minnesota jails, and according to the survey, 60% of jail staff said that they frequently see mental illness. And when I visited them personally across the state in northern, southern, and the metro area, they said that mental illness is prevalent inside their jails, and they're looking for some tools to deal with this issue as it's rising. According to the survey, 86% of jail staff believe that the jail's current ability to address the needs of inmates with mental illness was limited. Jails are unable to address treatment needs or provide discharge planning for people with mental illness. Nationally, according to the Department of Justice report in September of 2006, 64% of jail inmates had a mental health problem, and a quarter of jail inmates with a mental health problem had three or more prior incarcerations. So high recidivism rates for this population are evidence of the need for discharge planning in the jails. Persons with mental illness who are released from jail without discharge planning are unlikely to have a successful return to the community. Discharge planning helps to break the cycle of recidivism and keep the person with mental illness in the community connected with proper services and support. As you know, when people are incarcerated, their benefits, their SSI, their SSDI, MA are terminated, and this means when they walk outside the jail, they don't have their health care, their financial support, and sometimes they don't leave with medications. So they don't have their benefits to cover the costs of medications and treatment. So hopefully with discharge planning and collaboration between the county jail and social services, you can get benefits reestablished before they go out and people can get their medication. You know, when they're not doing well, they're discharged and they're told to go to social services and fill out an application. It's 36 pages long. They need a lot of different documents, proof of citizenship, pay stubs, listing of assets, dates of service for medical service and providers, bank statements. It's pretty a daunting task for somebody with serious mental illness who's not doing well. And without their benefits, it's very hard for them to get medication and treatment when they're released from jail. A relationship does exist between benefit restoration and lower recidivism rates of released inmates from mental illness. Additionally, as we're wrapping up here, there is currently no standardized brief mental health screen required to be used in Minnesota jails. Few jails conduct a mental health screen according to our survey of the jails, therefore limiting the number of people who can be identified and treated. Only about 15% of jail staff stated that they conduct a mental health screen that did not consist of only standard booking questions. The use of a mental health screening upon entry to jail and early identification can aid treatment interventions, help to reduce some of the disruptive behavior, reduce the risk of reoffense, and fulfill the jail's current ability to address the needs of people with mental illness. Individuals, of course, with mental illness are at an increased risk of suicide, and addressing mental illness is the key to reducing the suicide risk. People with mental illness also serve longer sentences and are placed in segregation at higher rates and also tend to remain there for a long time. And additionally, people with mental illness are more likely to be arrested and while in jail or prison, get in more fights, have more infraction, and have more sanctions, and end up in disciplinary confinement for quite a while. Real quick, and lastly, I wanted to share a story of a parent who couldn't be here today. Her son was in and out of the correctional system. It took a long time for her to get a mental health assessment or to get anyone's interest about what was going on with him. He would get better. He would go off his medications. He would become worse. He would go back into the correctional system and get even worse and then get released. The cycle, she said, was really hard on her and her family and for him. The last time he was in the correctional system, he was discharged to a motel, and he couldn't afford it, of course, so then he became homeless and he lived in the woods by a lake. Nowhere along her son's journey did he receive discharge planning. A lot of money, however, was spent on her son for attorneys, judges, jail, and prison costs, but very little on those things that would help him recover. No one wanted to assess him, provide him with medicine, stable housing, a job, or community support. According to her, there's a lot in H-File 196 that would have helped her son, mental health screening, discharge planning out of jails and prisons, and the mental health courts. Please support this bill and give people with a serious mental illness like her son a chance for a better life. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Long, for your testimony. Representative Cornish, I'm sorry I forgot to call on you earlier.
It's okay. Mr. Chairman, Representative Grayling, I don't want to rail on your bill because you were so nice to me in your committee, but there was there was one piece that I'm really concerned with. I got a complaint right away when the bill came up. Just one section of it. It was on the jail intake screening and mental health problems within the jail, county jail. And the thing they were concerned with was about staffing. And from an ex-jailer's standpoint, if people haven't got a mental problem when they come into the jail, they develop one really quick. I mean, they want library privileges, they want workout privileges, they develop physical disabilities, mental disabilities. And so what I'm worried about is the load that this is going to put on the jail. And what he was talking about was the ability to handle it with staffing. And so what specifically in the bill, do you think there's enough money in there? Is there appropriations for extra jail staff for the counties to handle the intake screening and the load that it would put on them? Or
Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Representative Cornish. It's Greiling, by the way.
What's that?
I don't think you said Greiling. I thought you said some other pronunciation of my name, but maybe not.
It's like Seifert and Seifert.
I know it. Some people let it go by, but I always correct it because my husband is fussy about it. But anyway, that aside, I have not heard this complaint from anybody, and the sections that we had complaints about are the ones we have done amendments on. So you're hearing from someone is news to me. It's a very short, free, standardized test. And, you know, Representative Cornish, people in jails might, I don't know about the physical things, but they actually try to not confess to their mental illnesses in prison or jails because then they get picked on if there's the stigma associated. So it's actually more of a case of under-identification than people jumping to say, no, I have a mental illness. No, I do. They don't do that. And there's research to back that up.
Representative Cornish.
Rather than argue that point, is the counties, did they have any, like the Association of Counties or the Sheriff's Association, did they have any problems with this, or do they think it's well taken care of enough in their appropriations to take care of the workload? Or
I have met with the counties, and they certainly have been included in any changes that we've made. I have not heard that concern.
That was my
listen to all concerns as they come forward. So if you have anybody, please send them to me.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Greiling, I thought that Representative Cornish was going to ask a little different question, one that I've received from my jail in Olmsted County. And I apologize for coming late if you've already addressed this, but maybe this isn't even in the bill. But there was a concern that that this legislation required jailers to assess somebody before they could put them in any kind of confinement. And people were concerned because sometimes they need to segregate somebody immediately, and just give me some comfort on that. Thanks.
Representative
Chair, Representative Liebling, you'll be happy to know that before you got here, we deleted those sections, and I had a wonderful meeting with your Sheriff Forcher, who turned, because I'm from Rochester, he knows my...
Borkhart.
Borkhart. Very good.
They have mispronouncing names, okay.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, Representative Cornish, you can see that just because I want others to be perfect doesn't mean I am. Sheriff Borkhart, who worked with me along with others. Actually, by the time he got to meet with me, it had already been changed as well. But I've heard loud and clear that we needed to change that section, and it's out.
Thank you. We have two more testifiers that I know of, and I ask that you keep your comments very brief. We have four more bills on the agenda. We have Mark Anderson and Ron Berge. If you'd like to come forward, Mr. Anderson. Yeah. Sorry for the, we just run over here, so if you could keep your comments brief. Introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair and Committee, my name is Ron Berge. I'm the Superintendent at the Ramsey County Correctional Facility.
Very good. Proceed, please.
Just here in strong support of the bill to let you know that, in a facility like ours with sentences up to a year, we averaging about 375 inmates a year. We continue to see increasing each year the number of inmates who come in who have existing mental health issues, continuing to see a pattern of them coming in without medications, not having the staffing or the resources to really address this situation properly. You know, it's an area that of great need, especially on the discharge planning, where we see these particular inmates that go out. We give them what we can do now is just a very short amount of their medications, and then there's what's really lacking is any kind of a follow-up or discharge planning. So oftentimes we see them coming right back into the system. So this kind of a resource could really do something to address the recidivism of this particular population.
Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Anderson, are you...
Well, morning. My name is Mark Anderson. I'm Executive Director of Barbara Schneider Foundation. And we were formed 7 years ago after a tragedy. Barbara lost her life in a mental health crisis call. Since then, we've been working with law enforcement community on the development of the CIT model. And there's a piece in this bill supporting CIT training local law enforcement agencies. We support CIT because we think it improves outcomes. When people in the community are frightened because somebody is in distress, mental health distress, in crisis, they call 911, and typically they'll get a police officer. But police officers are not mental health professionals. They need some training to be able to respond appropriately and effectively. We also think the CIT training it provides an opportunity for local communities to come together. The local hospital, the local, the county mental health people, the law enforcement, the sheriff, the courts, the corrections in that local area, and talk about how can they work together better to coordinate response to this population. So we think this is a very important program and hope you'll support it.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else who wishes to speak in favor of the bill? Is there anyone who wishes to speak in opposition to the bill? Are there any further questions of Representative Greiland? Is there any discussion by the committee? Any closing thoughts, Representative Greiland?
Mr. Chair, no, but I just, other than I would urge the committee to fund these important provisions. Thank you.
And I'd just like to say I really applaud the work that you've done on this bill, Representative Greiland. I know this has been a passion of yours for years, and to see it coming together like this is really extraordinary. There's just great stuff in this bill, and I hope it finds its way to success before the session ends.
Thank you.
The chair will move that the chair moves that House File 196 be passed and be referred to the Finance Committee on Finance with a recommendation that it be re-referred to the Health Care and Human Services Finance Division. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Greiland. Next on the agenda is House File 2210, Representative Clark. Representative Clark is not here. Representative House File 2217, Representative Dominguez.
Are we going to do that today? Yes. Yeah, but I'll probably. Yeah, I don't want to. That stuff that didn't do it.
Representative Dominguez, welcome to the committee. We have not a whole lot of time, so if you could present your bill and your testifiers, that would be great.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Real quickly, I'm going to introduce the bill, and I'm going to turn it over to the testifiers, seeing that we don't have much time. This bill was brought to me on House File 2217. It's related to an alternative dispute resolution, providing a study and assessment of alternative dispute resolutions. We do have an amendment. Would you like to
say an oral amendment?
Oral amendment.
Please state your amendment.
It's on line 1.17.
Okay. First of all, Representative Dominguez, would you move your bill?
I will move House File 2217.
Okay,
Mr. Chair.
And then the oral amendment is on line 17.
Right after where it says groups.
Yes.
Put in there academicians.
That's it?
That's it.
Okay. Representative Dominguez moves on line 17 after groups, comma, academicians, and private alternative dispute resolution practitioners. Any discussion? All those in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Amendment prevails. Go ahead, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm going to turn this over to our testifiers real quickly. The first one will be Eduardo Woolley.
Mr. Woolley, please introduce yourself for the record and please be brief.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much, members. My name is Eduardo Woolley. I heard the issues about names earlier, but thank you very much for allowing us to testify on this bill, and especially on the first day of spring. I am the director of Mediation Center at affiliated with Hamline University. I'm also the director of the Rice County Dispute Resolution Program in Rice County, and I also serve as the chair of the ADR Review Board for the Supreme Court. The purpose of Mediation Center is to facilitate and promote the use of collaborative processes of dispute resolution. One of the things that you should realize is what alternative dispute resolution is. It's not just mediation, which is a lot of what people think of, but it's also different methods that I think you'll be talking about here too: restorative justice, arbitration, mediation, different efforts along those lines. The purpose of this bill was, it was a result of a discussion that some of us had on the ADR review board that there wasn't enough information coming out on what was happening in the area of ADR, especially in the area of mediation and what's happening out in the courts. We're finding that there are some courts that are having problems. They're requesting more judges. We're also finding that some of the cases are getting moved back because there are increasing needs in other areas, for instance, in meth cases that are coming in. So some of the cases in conciliation court, housing, are being moved back and aren't getting the time that they need. You heard earlier on Monday from the community mediation programs as well, talking about some of the issues that they were facing. What this bill does is take a look at the larger picture and be able to come back to the legislature and indicate what kind of changes might best be approached in ADR so that we can alleviate some of the problems that we're seeing in education as well as in the courts. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Wally. Who's next?
Good morning. My name is Linda Neely-Lohman, and I'm here wearing several hats this morning. I am a mediator, contract mediator for the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. I'm also an attorney, and I also am an adjunct professor at William Mitchell College of Law, teaching two courses right now in ADR, Alternative Dispute Resolution. I support this bill because right now there is no centralized body of information accessible to people about what are the ADR options here in Minnesota. So as a practitioner, as a lawyer, I have an ethical obligation to advise my clients on what their ADR options are, but it's difficult to know what those are when there's no centralized body. I can talk about general arbitration, general mediation, but don't know what the specific options are here in Minnesota. As an educator at William Mitchell, my job is to teach my students about the ADR options available. And again, there's a lack of information about really what is specifically going on in Minnesota. Eduardo and I have written an article. We started to do some research on this to find out what is going on in Minnesota. And that opened a whole box of, there's a lot of things going on in Minnesota that even practitioners don't know about. And if we could do a more complete research of what is going on in Minnesota and make that available to the public, it would meet a great unmet need. Some of those unmet needs in the community involve that ADR options aren't known to members of the public. So people who are in conflict don't know if this is even an option. For example, I'm a volunteer mediator for the Ramsey County Conciliation Court, and just on Monday, after going through the whole mediation process and having the parties come up with a good settlement that they were both happy with, one of the parties said to me, why didn't I know mediation was an option before I had to file that filing fee, which I couldn't afford? And so that's an example of the need in the public. Also, we have a growing immigrant population here that the court isn't always the best forum for resolving those kinds of disputes and conflict in the community. Also, for lower-income people, they can't afford that. They can't afford to take time off of work to go to court. They certainly can't afford to hire an attorney. And ADR options, if we could educate the public more about what the options are, that would better serve those people's needs. Also in the schools, my daughter is lucky to be in a school that has a peer mediation program where they train the fifth and sixth graders to be peer mediators for conflict between students. And we would love to find out, are there other schools doing that? What are the best practices? And how can we get that conflict prevention and conflict resolution into the curriculum throughout the state?
Very good. Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Neely-Lohman. Next.
I'll try to be as brief as possible.
Thank
My name is Michelle Gullickson-Moore. I'm the executive director of Minneapolis Mediation Program. I want to tell you a short story on envy and jealousy. I am on the National Board of Directors of the National Association for Community Mediation. Two of my colleagues on that board of directors are part of statewide ADR associations or statewide ADR departments. I had a colleague of mine have to resign her position on the board of directors because she had just become the ADR director in the state of Nebraska. Nebraska's Department of ADR oversees all of the activities involved with solo practitioners and groups and departments that provide dispute resolution. And her job is to help create a place for those organizations and individuals to go. Every citizen in the state of Nebraska has access to some form of some service in their county. Every county is connected to this state department, and they have access to resources, information, and practitioners that are willing to travel, even in the most rural of counties. So if you're in Lincoln or if you're in Walt Hill, you actually do know where to go, who to talk to, and how to get a hold of the service that you're asking for. This is relatively recently put together, and it caused me a great deal of jealousy because I realized that Minnesota had a far more sophisticated infrastructure of statutes supporting dispute resolution, and yet lacked the cohesiveness of the state of Nebraska. Not that I want you to get into any form of a competition, but when I heard about the work of this group and the fact that we might be able to figure out how we came so well prepared in the statutes area and the development of how things should proceed, and then lack in areas that are rural in Minnesota, where the average citizen in International Falls may or may not have access to any form of dispute resolution, I'd like to see us be more well developed. I'd like to see us have something where everyone knows where to go for answers, everyone knows who to talk to, and there are answers and resources available for those individuals who are willing to do this kind of work.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Dominguez, we want to make sure we have your oral amendment correct. We have aging ears up here on some parts of the dais. Was it academicians or acts of omission?
No, academicians.
Academicians?
Yes.
Okay, we have her. My ears are better. Okay. Very good. Any more testimony?
None that I have.
Okay. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm a bit confused. I understand what you said, but I'm not sure that the bill says that. From what you said, I gathered you want more of an audit of availability and what's being practiced throughout the state and put that together. And then what you said, what I heard you say is that the end result is that more people would be aware of their options. But all that we're going to get from this working group through the legislation is a report. So you did not address how the people were going to become more aware, how your goal would be achieved, and this working group is, and then I have a question in here too, is this working group then going to direct the work of whoever is doing the study?
If I may make an attempt at a response,
Gullickson Moore,
that's a very good question. This is the first step, and we're modeling our work around the state of Maryland, where they did an assessment to find out what actually existed, to find out where there were gaps, to find out, what kinds of services were overlaps, what kinds of services were missing, and what was needed across the state. From there, they built a system that allowed them to fill in the gaps and provide more services and be more complete. So this is the very first step.
And Mr. Chair, Ms. Gillespie, and more, then is this going to be become the responsibility of the state of Minnesota?
Ms. Gillespie, and more.
I actually am not able to answer that question. I'm not sure we know yet. If I could defer that.
And Ms. Chair, will someone please answer what the we're hoping to get in line 2.1 on page 2.
Mr. Chair, I can answer that.
Senator Dominguez.
It's $120,000 for the biennium.
Representative Murphy.
But was I correct in hearing that mostly what you want to do is the assessment or an audit rather than a big study?
Yes, it would be.
Mr. Waller.
Also, Mr. Chairman, sorry. It would be also recommendations coming back on that, with that study.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Representative Dominguez, I see that there must be an affiliation with a law school and that this is a study as listed in the bill. Would this not be a good thesis for a student to work through rather than special funding? Isn't this kind of acquisition of new learning exactly what is supposed to happen at an institute of higher learning?
Ms. Neely.
Neely Lohman, thank you. What we have found is with the work group that that Eduardo has put together, we have a representatives from all different areas. We have academicians, we have business people, we have attorneys, we have practitioners from all different areas, and that perspective is going to be very valuable to feeding in how the assessment, how the study is done, and then taking the recommendations beyond the second step of this after the assessment is to create the recommendations for where does it go from here? What will the state do with that? And it's that, because it's a two-part piece, it's much better suited in the format that we have here than in as a thesis.
Any further questions or
thank
discussion?
You.
Representative Dominguez, do you have any closing comments?
Mr. Chair, just to say that I hope you can consider this and as a layover, and I would like to
Thank you all for your testimony. Thank you, Representative Dominguez. The chair will lay over House File 2217 as amended for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Next on the
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Next on the agenda is Representative Filston, House File 1393. Welcome, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move that House File 1393 be recommended the pass, or be laid over for possible inclusion.
Very good. You want to present your bill, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This was brought to me from the Department of Corrections, and this is regarding MNCOR, and I would like to turn it over to the Assistant Commissioner.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Dennis Benz. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Corrections. This bill has been heard in Policy Committee, and I'll try to be brief this morning. Basically, this is a bill that responds to many of the issues that were brought up in the Legislative Auditor's Report that was conducted last spring and early summer. In addition to that, it also addresses a couple of issues that caught media attention last year with respect to how we dispose of property versus product through our prison industry program. It also updates the statute in that we've gone from a subsidized industry program to a for-profit business model. So there's a fair amount of cleanup language in a couple of different statutes here. We've also worked very closely with the Department of Administration as the 16A statutes pertain to areas under their jurisdiction. So very quickly, if there's a handout that's coming around that several of you have seen in Policy Committee, but it does several things, and again, we'll go through very quickly here and try to summarize. 16A, 72, subdivision 7 and 8 really address the fact that prison canteen or the prison stores have been centralized, and those receipts now go into the revolving fund or the MinCorp checkbook, as opposed to standalone accounts at each of our seven adult prison locations. 16D, 181, 2B, D, and E addresses the state use law that we no longer use, and we'd like to eliminate the requirement that state agencies must purchase from MinCorp. We believe that getting out there and competing and winning business is serving us well, and we'd like to just eliminate the state use. 16C.23, this is an area that was addressed in the legislative auditor's report, and basically what we've tried to do here is distinguish between surplus property and product, how we dispose of property, which of course we have to follow guidelines in 16A and policy under Department of Administration, but it does differentiate the disposal or liquidation of product that we manufacture, and that was one of the clarifications that needed to be made as a result of the legislative auditor's report. I'm going to skip to 241.27. This is a section that really substitutes educational for vocational. It's cleanup language that we just simply had to address because we don't use the term vocational any longer. And it also defines that revenue will be used for inmate education, training, work, and skill development. And then 241.27, subdivision 3 and 4, talks about the reserve or the amount that we believe is necessary to carry in the MinCorp revolving account in the event of an economic downturn or flat sales. We believe that we've got to be able to operate for a minimum of 6 months, and we base this on our last 12 months of operation. And then 241.278 is a section that addresses getting funds back into the MinCorp revolving fund if we develop a contract with one of the county jails or county workhouses, and we have had to do that a time or two in the past. And then getting back to 241.021, the very back of the bill is the repealers, and basically this is again part and parcel to the state use law that we really haven't followed for several years now, and again we believe that we're out there winning business, and through good customer service we're keeping those businesses, and in fact, and now 3 years into our break-even operation, we are breaking even and we are making a dollar or two, so we've come a long ways from the $6 million subsidy that the agency used to get. And then there's one other section in the bill. It's section 401.15, that's on page 6, and that's another area that was addressed in the legislative auditor's report. It's cleanup language regarding CCA disbursements, and again, it's somewhat of a technical change. The statute used to read that statements had to be completed on or before the end of the quarter. That's difficult, so we gave them some wiggle room there. Within 60 days of the end of the quarter, they will report. So it's just consistent with what practice has been. And again, that's a very quick summary of the bill, and we're happy to answer any questions that you may
have. Thank you, Commissioner. Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, to the testifier, then 6.27 actually gives an almost 4 month buffer within each quarter. Is that correct? Is that necessary?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair and members, Representative Biskins, actually, I believe it's closer to 6 months of a cushion. And again, we were all around, or many of us were around during the downturn 4 or 5 years ago, and I can tell you that sales were very, very flat. A fair amount of our business is from public entities, and when there is a state budget issue like there was back then, it's going to be very difficult to stay afloat if we aren't able to carry some reserve. In addition to that, we're doing about $40 million a year in sales. It's also nice if we have we're moving now to more computerized equipment, computerized brakes in our shops. We have lots of equipment that's circa World War II that needs to be replaced, so we would use some of those dollars for capital investment. And the last point I would make is our population continues to go up, and every year we try to employ more and more inmates in prison industries, and this business is no different than any other. We need to have startup costs, and you don't make a lot of money the first year or two. So it's some comfort for us, and again, it's a big animal to feed. And if we have to stop manufacturing, that impacts on the safety and security of our institutions, because we're not able to put those offenders to work during the day. So this is, according to my CFO, who is available today to answer questions, somewhat consistent with industry standard of a business's size.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman and Commissioner, I think we misunderstood each other. I'm looking specifically at 6.27. All right. Right now, current law asks for the statement from participating counties, you know, by the end of each quarter. All right. Now we're changing law to be almost 2 months after the end of the quarter. Right. Is that length of time necessary? If somebody's keeping good books, I'm not sure 60 days is necessary.
Mr. Benson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Biskins, I apologize for misunderstanding, but what I would say there is, again, being in government, I know that all of the books don't get closed sometimes for 30 days beyond the quarter. The bills don't come in. We're not able to reconcile the books for, you know, maybe 30 to 45 days. So we believe that the 60 days is acceptable to us. It sort of is what it is, and we're just reviewing that data. And again, I think that this is a reasonable period of time for both the counties and for the commissioner to take a look at how the subsidy was spent.
Okay.
Not a question, Mr. Chair, but just a comment. And I understand bills don't come in, but that's why a good accountant carries accruals. All right, I don't know why you would need a full 60 days, all right, to have good accounting work submitted. But
Mr. Benson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Biskins, I wish I could tell you that we controlled this, but basically we are somewhat at the mercy of our county partners, and there obviously are several of them, and we can live with the 60-day interval if the legislature can.
Anything else? Thank you, Commissioner Haas.
I go back to, I almost had you come here yesterday to give some testimony on the short-term felons with your decision. Hopefully I don't have a double miscommunication, but it is my understanding that you will be pulling people together and partners together to give us some best practices and programs and facility recommendations on the care of short-term felons. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Haas, absolutely. We have always been willing. We will continue to be willing to work with our local partners to try to come up with a longer-term resolution to this issue that obviously is causing some consternation out there.
Thank you, Commissioner Benson, for your testimony. Representative Hillstrom.
I have nothing further.
Chair will lay over House File 1393 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Gardner. House File 457.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Good morning, Representative Gardner. The chair will move House File 457. And Representative Gardner, I understand this has some fiscal implications to our account, so we will need to, the recommendation will then be that we will lay this bill over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Is that your understanding?
That is, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Gardner, please present your bill, and I know this has come a few... Do you have amendments to the bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, as many members know, this bill had a rocky start, and I want everyone to know that I've worked a lot with the stakeholders to get this bill right and to help solve the problem. And so I do have an amendment. It's a delete all amendment. I would have preferred to do a line item one, but it just got a little messy. And that is the A070483 amendment.
Where is it? Okay, the chair will move the 0483 amendment. Is there any discussion? All those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Now we have the amended bill in front of us, Representative Gardner. Would you tell us what the amendment did?
Sure, and Mr. Chair, I actually had two minor oral amendments, one for a typo and one small phrase, and you were so fast for me that I didn't...
Okay, well, let's do your oral amendments now.
On page 3, line 17, this is subdivision 3, after the word check and before the period.
There's not a period on that line.
On 3.17, metal purchases only by check, period.
Oh, I see, the first check, I see.
Yes, I'm sorry. After check and before period, for purchases greater than $100. We're not sure exactly what the right number is here, Mr. Chair. I'm talking with the scrap recyclers about how to dissuade the thieves and still allow people with no fixed address and so on to...
The chair will move that on line 17, after the first check, delete the period and insert for purchases greater than $100, period. Is that correct?
That's correct, and I have one on the next page also.
Okay, and on page 4...
Page 4, line 16 and 17, on 4.16, delete the words must be confirmed through the, and then continuing on the next line, automated pawn system by the originating agency, delete that phrase for must be confirmed through the originating agency.
I am not understanding that, Representative Gardner.
Well, and replace it with must be made, so we're... this is a previous vestige of another version of this where we talk about the automated pawn system, and it shouldn't be in there.
So on line 16, we delete must be confirmed through the?
Correct.
And then on line 17, what do we do?
Delete the words automated pawn system by the originating agency.
Okay.
And then insert must be made.
Okay. The chair will move to delete on line 16, must be confirmed through the, and on line 17, automated pawn system by the originating agency, and insert the words must be made. Is that correct?
Correct.
Any discussion? All those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That oral amendment prevails. Are we ready now?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much.
Mr. Gardner.
Mr. Chair, this bill is designed to address the growing trend of metal theft from construction sites, abandoned homes, utilities, cell phone companies, and the like. I won't give you 20 minutes of describing the problem, but I will tell you what we've done to change the bill from its original iteration. What we're trying to do is have scrap metal recyclers, and there are about 120 of them in the state, register with the state, and because... last week, Senator Higgins and I discovered a better way to do this than the original bill. We're asking folks to sign up for the Minnesota Crime Alert Network, which allows the scrap recyclers to receive alerts when utilities and others know that they have stolen copper wire pipe, tubing, and the like. This is cheaper than doing the separate registration that was originally proposed and which is included in the fiscal note.
and the scrap recyclers would pay $50 to be part of that. So the DPS fiscal note that you have, which has something like $109,000 in the first fiscal year, that's not necessary now because DPS was going to create its own web-based registration system, but there already is one with the BCA's Crime Alert Network, so I think we saved some money there. Does that make sense, Mr. Chair? We still have the fiscal note for the incarceration on the penalties, though. Is that clear, Mr. Chair?
Yes, it is, Representative Gardner.
Thank you. The second main component is we are requiring the recording of contact information through picture ID of the sellers. Business customers are exempt, so if you have a long-term relationship with a business with a fixed address, such as a utility or a plumbing company, they would be exempt from that requirement. And anybody bringing in aluminum cans only is exempt. So all those scouts out there bringing in their cans would not be required to do that. I have visited the one scrap recycler and looked at how the logistics would work out, and it's clear that we can remove a lot of extraneous transactions by doing these two things. The third main component is requiring payment by check, and as you amended it, for purchases over $100. Aluminum cans are also exempt from that as well. The fourth one, we are asking scrap recyclers to use video cameras or still photography for vehicles and people entering the facility. I know this raised some concerns with some folks, and I did some research on data practices, and the requirement to send this data or any of the other contact information to police has been dropped. Video does constitute data, as with the pictures, with any identifying information, and there is a clause in here that data collected at the business would be private data. So if somebody comes in with a silly-looking T-shirt or something like that, you wouldn't be allowed to just email that over the Internet willy-nilly and have somebody's face or other contact information there. If any of that information is in the hands of the police, which they can request, that data would also be private as well. So I've gone through 13.82 to sort of figure out with a revisor a way to address that so that information isn't being shared outside the legitimate law enforcement purposes. In penalties, there are some felony penalties there for messing with stealing wire tubing and so on from our infrastructure, such as cell phone towers, electrical wires, and the like. I actually have my first documented case of this theft in my own district. A base for a cell phone tower in Lexington was stolen about a month ago. The copper base was stolen from it. The fiscal note includes funding for essentially five beds, people to be incarcerated for five offenders under that felony penalty. One of the parts that was controversial and what I've discovered is unworkable from a recycling standpoint is the tag and hold provision, which would have required that the stuff be held over for 5 to 10 days at a scrap recycler while the police had a chance to take a look at it. That's out. And any requirement that would have scrap recyclers use the automated pond system, which the city of Minneapolis has advocated, that is also out. The Crime Alert Network seems to fit the need for that quite handily, and the scrap recyclers tell me they're happy to engage in that activity. I also wanted to be clear that in the definitions that auto salvage yards are specifically not part of the definition of scrap metal recyclers. So if you have an auto parts yard, Melissa Hortman's business came to mind as an example, where they just buy vehicles and mine the parts out and sell those. Those are not included in that definition of scrap metal dealers unless they were to be buying copper pipe, copper wire, copper tubing off the street. Those are the main components, Mr. Chair, and I'd be happy to stand for questions.
Any questions? So cool.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gardner, first of all, thank you for working with
the stakeholders. I think the bill's come a long way. I still have a number of issues and concerns. Candidly, I think if a couple of them are addressed, it's probably a bill I can support. At this point, it's not, but it's come. It certainly has come a long way, and I appreciate that. A couple questions for you. You mentioned that I believe what I heard you say was that businesses that interact with a scrap dealer on a routine basis aren't. There's some registration requirements that aren't going to be required for them, or.
Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, that's correct. Much of the volume that's brought into a scrap metal dealer is from other businesses.
Can you point out in the bill where that I was looking?
Certainly.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
It's not where. Let's see. On page 2, line 22, the person shall not be required to furnish or keep such record of any property purchased from merchants, manufacturers, or wholesale dealers having established place of business.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Representative Gardner. if we can turn to page 4, line 5 through 10, this is the criminal provision for not complying with the recording requirements. Mr. Chair, Representative Gardner, I have a concern. As I read this language, this would make a dealer guilty of a gross misdemeanor for negligently failing to comply with all the requirements here. I don't think that's your intent. I think we need some language here to talk about intentionally failing to comply with the requirements, the recording requirements. I know that you have the language in here that they reasonably should know is ordinarily used by railroad, other transportation, et cetera, but it's missing language regarding intent. And I think to hold somebody accountable for a gross misdemeanor without an intent requirement, particularly when we're talking about a record-keeping issue. Right now, somebody could be convicted of a gross misdemeanor if they just made a mistake in keeping the records. They jotted down some of them, but not all of them. Now, of course, prosecutors have discretion, et cetera. Hopefully that type of prosecution wouldn't happen. But I think, and I don't have language to suggest right now, but I know we're laying this over, and Representative Gardner, before I can support this, I think that needs to be fixed.
Representative Gardner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, I appreciate the input, and unlike most people in this group, I'm not an attorney here, so I would be happy to work with you or with a revisor or House Research to find an appropriate tightening of the language.
Representative Dallas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Coles.
I've got one more, Mr. Chair. I've got two more. I'm just gonna do one though. Representative Gardner, before I ask my question, I still have concerns about subdivision 8 on page 4, and the hold. And if this is going to end up in the omnibus bill, I suspect I'm going to have an amendment related to that. Representative Gardner, I'm concerned that we are potentially holding property or requiring a dealer to hold property. There's no compensation for them to do it. If we're talking about a big, you know, things taking up a lot of space, I have some concerns about that, but I'm going to work on that between now and whenever we mark up the final bill. But Representative Gardner, I still have concerns about the video camera requirement. I think that for some scrap dealers, I'm sure it's not going to be a problem at all. In fact, some of them probably, I would suspect, have systems like this in place. But as I read what you're requiring a dealer to do, it's not one video or still camera, it's two. It's one out in the parking lot, so they're capturing, or at the gate as people come in, so they capture the vehicle and license plate information. It's also one inside the premises where the transaction's occurring. And I have some concerns about, number one, why that's really necessary, and number two, whether we're putting especially small dealers at risk of not being able to afford this. So that's my concern, and Mr. Chair, in light of that, I would at this time move to delete page 3, line 20 through line 33, so subdivision 4. It's because of that concern. I think if that goes away and we can figure out those couple other issues that I have, I think, Representative Gardner, you got a good bill. You got a much better bill than what we saw in Representative Mulery's committee.
Good morning, Mr. Representative.
Representative Coles has moved to delete on page 3, subdivision 4. Representative Gardner, you want to respond to that?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Representative Coles, thank you for the observations. I know we've talked informally similar about it. The requirement on two cameras actually comes from the suggestions of the Institute for Scrap Recycling Industries in their own manual on how to combat metal theft, and their suggestion and the one that St. Paul Police made is that people are using stolen vehicles to bring the material on site. So you may have a vehicle that doesn't actually belong to the, is not in the possession of the person who owns it. The on the issue of cost, Representative Olin has been very helpful in understanding how this issue would address rural scrap metal dealers. He's from Thief River Falls, and he has an acquaintance who calls him quite regularly about the status of the bill. And that's why I had the video or the digital stills in there. So that's why that's there.
So, of course, is it the cost that you're concerned about? The mandate, the invasion of something?
Yes.
Okay.
I think it's all free, Mr. Chair. I'm just not comfortable with it. I don't see it as necessary. We have the recording requirements here. We have a paper trail. We have I'm primarily concerned about the small guys out there. Somebody doing more than just aluminum cans, but maybe not running a business that has revenues of several hundred thousand dollars or $1 million a year that can absorb something like this easily. And I do have some concerns about the privacy issue as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I know we're in a hurry to finish. We have Representative Clark, so I'll just hold my question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My concern was right along the lines of Representative Coles, and although I don't have many black helicopters flying above my home, I am concerned when, every so often, I am concerned that we're actually asking a private business to take photos of not only the individual but also their car and then keeping them. There's nothing in here that says within 30 days, a week, a month, that you'll purge this data. In this digital age, I mean, every day we hear about identity theft, we hear about, someone hacking into something. If these are digital photos, they're going to be stored electronically. And if this, like Representative Cole said, if this is a small business, it's going to put in the bare minimum. I would assume it'd be pretty darn easy to hack into, and that's a lot of data for including accounts and a number of different identifiers and personal data in there. That's a lot of information floating around, and again, I don't mean to be disrespectful to those in the scrap metal industry, but I don't think they're computer sophisticated, and this is something that they've planned for in their business.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gardner, I had some other questions about the bill that I'm not going to raise now, and they don't pertain to this section. But on this issue, I just want to remind members that, you go to Target, you go to Walmart, they're videotaping you all the time. I mean, you are under surveillance in a lot of places these days. So, I'm not inclined to take this out at this point. I'm concerned a lot about privacy and about the fact that we're always under observation and all that. I really don't think that this is a concern next to what we see in society generally.
Representative Coles, real
quick. The only comment I would say, Representative Liebling, I certainly understand that and respect that. The difference, though, is that we are mandating it here. We're requiring it here. Target and Walmart and others are choosing to do it voluntarily. And that's the concern, is that the government's coming in and saying you have to collect this information.
Mr. Chair, if I could just quickly go, but in terms of it being put on the internet or somebody seeing it, I mean, that is all out there all the time.
Representative Eastland, and then Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would echo some of the concerns. I mean, if you've ever been to a small scrap iron recycling center, I mean, I'm looking at the bill and wondering how you could do it. Much of it is done outside. Much of it is done, a lot of it's cash transactions. I mean, if we're going to regulate this industry, we're going to have a huge effect on many of those small dealers. And maybe there's another way to do this, but I think this is going a little too far just in terms of the potential cost, because there's a lot of businesses that would just not comply, and we'd be making some criminals.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gardner, I thank you for bringing this bill forward. It's really interesting and kind of related to Representative Cole's question is with the cameras. You know, I drive in, I live in North St. Paul, and I take the Phelan corridor in here every day. It's pretty neat, by the way. Works. Thanks for whoever voted on that and got that done. But I pass one of these businesses almost every morning, and it's amazing the traffic you see. And Representative Coles talks about Target, and they're talking about Target. Well, I think Target better pay attention to some of their grocery carts, because often I'll see people coming in with grocery carts full of different things, and it's amazing what they're selling. And it's you know, as we come down here to talk about these things, it's just fascinating. So I think they need to put GPS on their grocery carts. Or but I'm just wondering regards to you know, you're talking about the cameras, but how does this, you know, often in, or recently in the news they've been talking about the catalytic converters, and is there anything in your bill that talks about you know, I mean, it just seems odd that, you know, that these businesses would buy them. You know, I mean, if people come in with maybe, you know, someone might come in with one catalytic converter, or if you're a business, you might come in with a bunch, you know, if you're Midas Plus or something. But if you're the average citizen, you come in with, you know, again, the shopping cart full of catalytic converters, is that going to be videotaped, or is this, where does that show up in your bill? I just can't get my arms around this catalytic converter thing. It seems like
they're real hot, so you don't want to.
Well, they've cooled down perhaps by this point, but
right.
Maybe you can answer the question.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Lilly. I could add a lot of stuff to this bill. The beer wholesalers want beer kegs and their theft to be a felony. The milk crate guys with the grocers and the dairy industry want to add tougher penalties for milk crates, and catalytic converters have been in the news lately because of all the precious metals in there. Things can change in 5 years, so I'm trying to keep it as broad as I can. I do know that there is a catalytic converter recycling business. I think it's in Blaine, and they actually use some of the suggested stuff that's in this bill, payment by check over $100, checking ID, license plate numbers, and so on. And believe me, I'm watching this. This is also another documented theft in my area in the suburbs, because at park and ride lots, people have had their catalytic converters sawed out. So you can be assured that I'm checking that out as part of this bill, and we want to see where some of the trends are. I will mention too that we're going to do some training over the interim.
Okay. We're running out of time here, members. Representative Lilly, and then Representative Liebling.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Gardner, so going back to the amendment, though, so would these shopping cart people, how are they recorded again? I mean, if they show up with the cart, you're not going to get a license number, or you get cart number 17. So do they have to have an ID again? And can you just kind of explain
sure.
that a little bit to me?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lilly, that is actually one reason we have the camera at the cashier, so that people who are walking in can do that. And so you, because they don't come in a vehicle, and they come in on bicycles as well. And I have noticed that the scrap recycling industry does know, because of recent media coverage, that they need to be cognizant of this issue and train their employees. And I know that's one key issue that we're all going to be working on over the interim.
Representative Lieber.
I just want to make sure, Mr. Chairman, we're going to have an opportunity to vote before. I'd hate to have Representative Gardner's bill held over or laid.
We are going to vote on the amendment as soon as everyone has asked their questions, and I hope they're done after Representative Lieber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just some concerns were raised, Representative Gardner, about the cost of this provision, and I just wanted to see if, you know, these days it doesn't seem to cost a lot to buy this kind of equipment. I mean, the costs are dropping all the time for various kinds of technology, and I just wonder if you've had any opportunity to find out what it might cost for a business to install this kind of equipment.
Representative Gardner. Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, I actually did carve out the tax credit part for equipment, including cameras, from the original bill, put it in a separate bill, and that did receive a hearing in the tax committee, and they have laid that over for the omnibus, so we separated that out. and there is a fiscal note for that as well, so that it wouldn't cause an undue burden. And that's also another reason we focused on the digital skills instead of just the cameras. I don't know the specific answer to your question about the cost of the system.
Representative Liebling,
so
final question.
If I'm understanding you then, Representative Gardner, so you've provided in the separate bill for a tax credit for these businesses that provide this, so...
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling.
Gardner.
Go ahead. That's correct.
Oh. Anything else, Representative Liebling? Okay, then, Representative Coles has moved to amend on page 3, delete subdivision 4, pages 3 and 4, renumber the remaining subdivisions, and on page 4, line 12, delete 5 and insert the number 4. Is what,
if that's what staff says.
That's what staff has said. I didn't just come up with it, Representative Coles. Is that what your amendment is? Is that, are we good to go? Okay, any further discussion? Okay, all those in favor of the Coles amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed signify by saying no.
No.
No. The amendment does not prove.
See a show of hands, Mr. Chair.
The division has been called for by Representative Coles. All those in favor of the Coles amendment, raise your hands, please. Jeez. I'm glad everyone wanted to be here on time for the adjournment.
Well, I just got off the
All those opposed to the Coles amendments, raise your hand, please. Mr. Olin, are you voting?
What's the bill, and I'll tell you.
This is on the Coles amendment to delete section 4 of the bill on the video security cameras.
If I were to vote, I'd have been voting with Coles.
Okay, well, what do we have for...
So I wasn't here in time to vote. So.
Mr. Chair, could I inform Representative Olin of something that would address this?
No, you may not.
Okay, thank you.
We have a 4-4? 5-5 tie. The motion does not prevail. And for the discussion, all those chair will lay over House File 1393. I'm not sorry, that's not right. House File 457 as amended for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Finance Bill. Thank you, members. This meeting's adjourned.